Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Fueling Forward podcast. I'm your host, registered dietitian, and former professional runner, Maddie Alm. Today's guest is Shannon Roberry. Shannon is a San Francisco native and Duke alum. She's a former professional runner for Nike and former U.S. record holder in the 1500 with a 3:56. She's one of the most accomplished U.S. 1500 meter runners of all time. She's an 8-time member of Team USA, including a 3-time Olympian. She's the 2009 World Championships bronze medalist in the 1500 and the 2016 Indoor World Championships bronze medalist in the 3K. After finishing 6th at the 2012 Olympic Games in the 1500, Shannon is getting upgraded to a bronze medal due to 3 athletes getting caught for doping. She will receive her bronze medal at the LA Olympics in 2028. Shannon is also an Emmy-winning sports broadcaster for the Paris Olympics. She's the co-author of 2 books, Medalist Mindset and Strong as a Mother. She's also the co-founder of the nonprofit Imagining More. I hope you enjoy hearing from Shannon. Shannon, welcome to the Fueling Forward podcast. I'm so excited to have you here today.
Thank you for having me, Maddie. It's great to get to join you.
Yes, and I so appreciate you taking the time. With you've got a lot going on right now, I know, but really grateful for you to be here and just share your knowledge with younger athletes in the sport. And I would love to start by having you tell us a bit more about yourself and how you got into running to begin with.
Not at all the traditional route, which I love, and I think it helped me be a better runner in the long term. But I started out as a dancer, and I did Irish dancing, ballet, and then Irish dancing. Why I loved Irish dancing is because it had, I realize in retrospect, you know, like I didn't realize it when I was 5 or 6, but like as I look back, I loved the competitive aspect. Irish dancing has competitions where I would be on stage in front of, you know, 1 to 3 judges, sometimes alone, usually alone, performing these complicated routines. And so I discovered I loved that feedback of kind of how I was doing, what the progress I was making, and areas that I could improve. And the cool thing is that so much about that Irish dancing training and that performance under pressure, as well as the physical development of, you know, hip and core strength, foot and ankle, both like agility and kind of, you know, I'll talk about the hops and running. I was doing that on a daily basis from the age of 5 to 16. And so I really thought I was headed down that path. But freshman year of high school, I had a friend who was doing this thing called cross country. And I was like, I don't know what that is. But when I found out that it was running and I had always been told I was fast, I figured I would give it a try. And I got really lucky that the Andy Chan, who's still the coach at my high school, Sacred Heart Cathedral in San Francisco, it was his first year as a coach. And he really cared about the athletes on the team, not just for what they could achieve, but for who they are and for laying those strong foundations. And he really set me up on a long-term path for success and, you know, remains a friend to this day. So I went from Sacred Heart, signed at Duke for college, and then signed with Nike out of college and competed for about 15-ish years. Really, really proud of the long career I had, but an unexpected path to get there.
That's incredible. And it's funny, we actually have a sort of similar sport intro. I jump roped initially. So there's a lot of that like jumping and that coordination, and it's so different from running, but it's so good for young athletes to develop. And I know you have young kids. Can you speak to, in your experience, what not specializing in running early did for you as a runner?
Yeah. If you're a parent listening, I encourage you to not specialize your child in running too early. Introduce them to running. Help them fall in love with running. Help them find role models and inspiration through it and the ability to kind of come into themselves through it, whatever it might be. But the kind of specificity, especially of distance running, if you go into that too early, you really limit your long-term development. I think from a physical and an emotional, like a psychological standpoint, because not only is it very linear, you know, running forward or in the case of the track in circles, but also, you know, as soon as you've run a certain time, the only thing better than it could be to run a faster time. And that pressure for performance is a lot if you don't have the kind of mental tools to kind of balance that, because the like as we grow, we won't have PR after PR after PR. You know, you and I both know that. It took me, I think it was 6 years to go from 4 minutes to 3:59 in the 1500 as a professional athlete. And if you don't have the mental and emotional fortitude, you could easily leave the sport just out of frustration. But physically as well, you know, as you've been touching on, the ability to, you know, develop that lateral movement, the hip and core strength to just like kind of strengthen your body through this cross training, whatever it is, keeps your body healthier and more resilient.
Absolutely. And I love thinking about that mental fortitude piece because other sports, you measure success in such a different way. And in running, we are always going to be our harshest critic and we're always measuring ourselves against the clock. And it's great to have experience with other sports where you feel success in different terms. And that might help you broaden your mindset in running when you do hit that point where PRs are few and far between and it's a long journey to get there. So I love that advice for sure. And I'm so curious about the San Francisco running scene. When I picture growing up in San Francisco, I picture Princess Diaries and her riding her electric scooter to school over the hills, and it's so hilly out there. What was running like in San Francisco, and what was that like growing up there?
You know, it wasn't, I mean, I wasn't a princess and I didn't have a scooter, but I actually went to high school right like at the top of Pack Heights. Actually, it was somehow this anomaly where like it seemed to be downhill in every direction, mostly because whenever we were finishing the run, I was always tired and I was, you know, this hill seemed even steeper. But, you know, I wouldn't say that like those early urban runs were the types of runs I love to do. But it all was new to me. And so I was caught up in just like understanding the sport and having fun with friends. And, you know, that I would say sort of northeastern part of the city, while largely concrete and hilly, is different from the part of San Francisco that I grew up in and live in currently, which is kind of Golden Gate Bar Park, the western side of the city, Golden Gate Park, Great Highway, I guess it's called Sunset Dunes now, Lake Merced, the Presidio, which now is stunning. I can do a 15-mile run on soft surfaces without repeating. There might be some lights that you have to cross, but there actually is a great expanse just within the city itself of soft surface running trails. And there's an incredible running community. If you go to Kezar Stadium, which is the public track in San Francisco, on a Tuesday night, for example, you will see hundreds of athletes from different running clubs that are doing track workouts. And, you know, not to mention the people running all over. So it's a very active city. It hasn't ever been one that people thought much of from a running perspective. The high cost of living and like their, you know, the Stanford running program and Cal running program are outside of the city itself. But it really was a wonderful place to start running because I could have, you know, like I would dodge people when I was running on the sidewalk and like work on my tactics, but I could also kind of get lost in Golden Gate Park or the Presidio and feel miles and miles away from the hustle and bustle of the city.
Wow, kind of the best of all worlds, it sounds like, which is
It was
nice.
great. I love it. It's great for me. I mean, I think, you know, it's hard to find many like urban metropolitan cities that also have a great like kind of outdoor enthusiasm. And so I'm proud to be a part of the community here.
Amazing. And growing up in San Francisco, you know, being in multiple sports, what was the conversation around food and nutrition like for you when you were growing up?
I was so lucky that my aunt was a nutritionist. And when I was a little kid, I remember, and it was like this sort of like drip of information without me ever even realizing it. But as I reflected, I remember like one of my favorite games to play with my aunt Susie. You know, she worked with families and with kids, and so in her office when I would visit her, she had a shelf and she would show me like two peanut butters, a Jif peanut butter and an all natural peanut butter, and she would like. I like vividly remember this for whatever reason. But she'd be like, "Choosy moms choose Jif. Which one would you choose, Shannon?" And I would be like, That one, the whole, like the all natural one. I was being taught from a very early age that like there are choices we can make about the quality of our food, and I wouldn't say I'm an expert that I've ever been an expert, but like even that awareness that kind of the what we're being told may not always be the best for us. And so I was, you know, my household, it was a multi-generational household with my parents and my grandparents. My mom, with her sister's influence, was, you know, very healthy. It was like milk or water were the choices, maybe 100% juice in the fridge, like, you know, whole grains and things like that. But then my grandma Noni was the one who'd take me to Irish Dance, and afterwards we'd go to the 7-Eleven and I'd buy a Slurpee and donuts. Like, it wasn't forbidden to have these things, but they were not regular parts of my diet. And so I think when I got later into, you know, running, and I started to be confronted with some of these imbalanced approaches to nutrition and to fueling, it was hard. And, you know, I think I did have some times where, like, you know, I needed to recalibrate like what was on my plate, but I never got so far out of touch because I had this strong foundation of like food is fuel and like an essential component to our health.
Absolutely. And it makes such a big difference the way that food is talked about at home. And just having that be a casual, open conversation about these are nutrient-dense choices that we try to make most of the time. But there's room for Slurpees, there's room for donuts. It's so important to have that kind of middle ground balanced mindset instead of that all or nothing mindset that can really come back to get us when we get a little bit older and we learn more about food and body image comes into play, that can be really, really challenging. So it sounds like you had a great relationship with food growing up. Then you went to Duke, which is kind of on the other side of the country. What was that transition from high school to college like for you? You know, moving away from home, being more immersed in the sport.
It was hard. I mean, I purposefully chose Duke because I loved the coach, Kevin Germain. I knew I could get a great education. I didn't realize professional running was a career option. It didn't even register with me until maybe junior year. And so I was really trying to find this place where I could have this great college experience while being part of a team. But I mean, I just remember the first week of college when I was with the group. We did an 11. There were women going further, but I did 11 miles on a Wednesday for a long run, and we did a second long run of 11 miles on Sunday. And in my entire high school experience, I had done two 11-mile long runs. Like, everything else had been so much shorter. So, you know, the increase in workload was a lot, both academically and then from a training perspective. And I was suddenly spending time with a bunch of other young athletes. And, you know, not everyone had that same kind of perspective of food as fuel. And so, you know, when you, it is hard when you come into an environment where, you know, you're making the choices that you think are the right ones, but you're seeing others make very different choices. And it can be especially hard with, things like diet and nutrition, where sometimes those, or other things as well, where like sometimes those choices that may not be the best ones in the long term might have near term success for people or near term results. And so, you know, I think though that was a period where I really kind of struggled to kind of figure out how I could stay healthy. And like, and my freshman year of high school, I had some amenorrhea. I had lost my period for, I forget how many months. But ultimately came down to with a mix of like I did acupuncture to help like systemically, and then I also did you know, conversations around like what's on my plate and how do I incorporate more healthy fats and like a more balanced diet so that my body is getting the fuel it needs. And fortunately, like, you know, besides that freshman year challenge, I was able to come out the other side. And for my entire professional career, even when I ran my American records, was able to have a pretty regular cycle and a, like, you know, a pretty healthy body, like minimal injuries, and a really long career. It's hard when you're like in the moment and you're trying to figure it all out and you're trying to figure who you are even as a person. But I'm here to vouch for the fact that like investing in the long game is the right one, is like the right choice.
Yes, for sure. And you know, sometimes, like you said, we stumble a little bit. We hit those moments where, you know, maybe you lose your period. And what's great about having those kind of checkpoints is it's an opportunity to make some changes. And it's sort of a fork in the road where you can say, okay, something is probably not right. What can I do to make this better? Sometimes athletes are great at making those changes and suddenly, you know, doing a 180. Sometimes they're not. And so for you, when you go to college, you're in the dining hall, you're surrounded by other teammates. You know, a lot of times when we get to college, that comparison starts to creep in a little bit. Did you find yourself struggling with that relationship with food or making the right choices for your body?
I did. Yeah, I think I wish I could. Like, I don't even wish I could claim it was easy. It certainly wasn't easy. And it was a constant kind of recommitment to myself and belief that, like, these choices, while different from others, were the ones that were right for me long term. I'm also like a very good at compartmentalizing. I think sometimes to the extent that I had to kind of just like disassociate from those things and sort of go into my tunnel vision of what I needed to do and really lean into the schoolwork and the stretching and all the other stuff. And so it was a variety of like approaches I took to try to like come out the other side whole. It was a wonderful experience, but college is transformative and transformation isn't always is often not easy. And so it was, I think the thing that you said that I would repeat for everyone is, you know, when you have those turning point moments, whatever they are, whether it's an injury, whether it's losing your period, whether it's whatever, if you can slow down enough to try to think about what might have caused it, is there anything that you could adjust moving forward so it's less likely to be an issue in the future? You know, once again, like rather than the quick fixes or just trying to like forget and move on, can you really take some time to use that as a sign to like pause and reflect? I think that approach will, like for me at least, has served me well no matter what the challenge has been. And so I would say, yes, it was hard. My main thing I'm proud of is just that I kept trying to stay like true as much as I could to like what like the village around me was like encouraged, like you know those people I trusted were like in telling me was the right choice, and you know where I needed to tweak to like just be open to that.
Yes, for sure. And I think it's so important to highlight that, you know, you, Shannon Roberry, one of the greatest American 1500 meter runners of all time, struggled with comparison in college and looked at other runners to see what you should be doing. And you were able to make the choices that ultimately were best for you. And I just remember back in college when I walked on, I was the slowest one on the team. It was impossible not to compare myself because, you know, you have these other teammates who are running so fast. And unfortunately, it's not always sustainable. And especially when, like, I think about indoor season for me is the epitome of like not sustainable. You know, everyone's running crazy times in indoor and you're panicking. And then come outdoor, there's all these injuries popping up, which is so unfortunate. But really just remembering that you are the only one who knows what your body needs. And your body is so different from everyone else's. Staying the course is going to get you so much farther than trying to do something because somebody else is doing it.
I remember someone giving me the advice, you know, this idea of competition in terms of and comparison in terms of me versus others as and me versus myself, and both exist and can exist and will exist. But the more you can focus on the me versus myself in terms of, you know, where am I compared to where I was last year to compared to where I want to get? What are the things that I can be doing? You know, this control the controllables idea that's so common amongst athletes. It's a lot easier said than done. But for me, that shift of recognizing that outward focus on what other people were doing was driving me crazy and not helping me. And the more that I could focus on myself and what I could be doing, the better. Now, my college coach was a wonderful coach, and he even would say, like, I remember asking him, you know, why is it if I'm going to be a pro athlete and the pro athletes look like that and I look like this, like, what am I supposed to do? Fortunately, at that moment, He said, just keep committing to the training, keep doing all the things, and you will get to where you need to be. And I was, and that was a pivotal moment. I still remember it. And I was lucky that that was the guidance I had. As a professional athlete, the coaching I had was not so healthy and not so balanced. And I struggled to kind of find my footing in a space that was where the coaches themselves were comparing athletes' bodies to each other and to others out there. But I know for me, like I survived those things because of that strong foundation I had. And so I think for anyone listening, especially if you have these younger, I mean any age people you love, but especially when you have these younger athletes, these younger people, like the foundation you can set for them, the voices that you can help them have in their head in those moments of like challenge can make such a big difference in the long term.
Yes, it's so important if you are looking at running in college, ask coaches questions about things like that. Find out what their philosophies are, how they would support you in those moments. It is so much better to know what kind of environment you're getting into before you get there than to struggle. And it sounds like you were very fortunate to have an incredible college coach. Your college career really took off, and by the end of college, you had the opportunity to sign a professional contract. So, what was that progression like for you in college? What was it like to realize the dream of being able to become a professional runner?
It was so unexpected because, like I said, I didn't even realize that was something that was in the cards for me that I could even dream of doing. When I signed the actual contract, it was like the start to my running career, not straightforward in that I had just won NCAA indoors in the mile, came second in the 3K, was kind of top of the world, top kind of prospect for shoe companies coming out of college. But about a month after that indoor nationals, I ended up with a stress fracture in my left femoral neck, and my collegiate career was done. And so I was then looking to sign with shoe companies, not racing in NCAA outdoors, and not sure with such a severe injury, like, when I would be back to running. I did. I'm grateful that I was able to sign a shoe contract. I am most proud of the fact that. One year out when most others had written me off and the odds were very stacked against me, I did what we were talking about and instead thought, okay, what a stress fracture is a chronic injury, which means something was off day after day, week after week, month after month to cause that pr breakdown. For me, I have a leg length difference. My left tibia is 7 millimeters longer than my right. I didn't know that at the time, but once I got injured, I did all of the kind of investigation, did a bone length scan, got treatment, and ultimately kind of developed this, got orthotics, got a strengthening routine, got a good recovery team around me for massage and chiropractic to keep my body balanced. And a year later, made my first Olympic team and then didn't have any other injuries, like major injuries that kept me out of championships until postpartum when I had to rush back to protect, like to keep my contract active. So, I think it was a very hard start to a pro running career, but I tell that story because I think it just is yet another example of how in those moments that seem really low, and they are, you have a choice how you kind of want to step forward from them. And maybe you're even like crawling before you can walk. I couldn't even walk without crutches, but incredible things can happen when you trust the process.
Yes, and when you give yourself time and space to heal, and you're
Yes.
not rushing things and forcing things,
Yes.
and it sounds like you were really smart about that. And if anyone's listening right now who's dealing with an injury, maybe they're listening to this while they're cross training, do you have any words of wisdom for getting through a major injury like that where you're just not sure what running will look like for you afterwards?
Oh man, it's in the moment I just remember, I would watch Secretariat or like one of those like horse racing movies and cry because I would wonder like, will I ever be better again? And maybe there's a few people who love cross training, but if you're supposed to be running and you're stuck cross training, like you are not a happy camper. So I had many teary sessions. But I think, I just come back to and encourage everyone out there, like if this is the first time this injury has happened to you, like take the time to figure out why it happened. If this injury has happened multiple times, like or more than once, like there's definitely something that you should get to the bottom of. And like cry when you need to, but like channel that energy into figuring yourself out so that you can come back stronger, more self-aware, more resilient, and like, less likely that there might be other setbacks. There will be other setbacks in the future. That's life, but they don't have to be the same things again and again. And so I just encourage anyone to kind of like going through those hard moments to just really focus on, see them as a like an opportunity to invest in yourself. And even for me, at least, that shift in mindset of like, instead of woe is me, to like, what can I do? How am I going to take ownership of this? How am I going to give myself the best shot? And then each day diligently going after it with that routine that I had created with that team's help around me.
Yeah, I love how you broke that down into, taking it as an opportunity to learn. And, that saying, like, insanity is the definition. It's like doing the same thing over and over again
Yeah.
and expecting a different result. Getting
Is the
injured.
definition of insanity.
Yes,
Yes.
exactly. Like
And we're all
getting
a little
injured.
crazy, right? Like we're
Of
all
course we are.
distance runners, so we're all like a little
Yes.
nutty, but I love that about us.
Yes.
But our strength can be our weakness if we don't recognize, like, I think that's like also something that an injury will teach you is like kind of cautious and like being cautious and having discretion, like going hard when you need to, but also like I would have these, there's a lot of hours that we're out running on the trails, but I would have these like conversations with myself, these internal conversations of like, body, I'm asking a lot of you. I know I am, but I'm also going to commit to recovering where I can. Like sort of this, like make commitments to yourself of like, I will go hard because that's how I roll, but I will not forget that recovery is an essential part of this process and that like some days it's better to listen to your intuition than to just push through because of that compulsion to hit that mileage goal or that pace goal or whatever it might be. Because that's often like those moments where you're like intuition doesn't sync with what you have on paper. Those can often be turning point moments for better or for worse if you don't kind of listen to all the signs around you.
Yes, absolutely. And it sounds like you took full advantage of that reflection point for yourself. You were able to
Tried.
do some thinking and just remember that it's so important to take care of yourself, which I'm sure was really helpful going into the professional environment. You just kind of alluded to this, but the conversation around body image and fueling as a pro, it sounds like was very different than
Yes.
as a collegiate athlete. Can you speak a little bit more to that experience?
Ugh. Don't want it to get too negative, but it was, I would say, with the exception of Pete Julian, who I had at the end of my running career, my coaches fixated on body image in a way that wasn't healthy, and that at the moment, I thought that I had to, my first pro contract said I had to work with this specific coach or a Nike approved coach at Nike's sole discretion. I was really pigeonholed into who I could be with. And, it was really, it, luckily, I was coached mostly long distance. So it was really the hardest when I was in these team training camps. But the kind of feedback that I would be getting and comparison that I would be getting placed on me, and even, whether it was external or amongst my team, it was really toxic. And it didn't get better when I changed programs either, which is, I think speaks to the need to better vet our coaches, better train our coaches, and protect our athletes, men and women. It wasn't just the women that got this kind of feedback. When I was competing, for the longest time, it seemed like I just needed to figure out how to be tough enough. And I just leaned on my parents and ultimately my husband to try to like manage these environments that were really emotionally abusive. But eventually, as I kind of became a mom and could reflect on the environment I was in, and you know, the public perception also shifted. Like in like 2019, with the kind of New York Times articles about maternity and other articles that followed, there was a shift in terms of tolerance, to at least it felt like, and I had to kind of like the environment, like understand or come to terms with the fact that like the environment I was in that made it made me feel like I had to just be tough enough to survive it, was not an environment that I would ever allow my child to be in if I had any chance to do something about it. And really, and then having better coaches like Pete to remind me like it doesn't have to be that way. Like, and all of that really, I think, helped me in a good way finish my pro career with a lot more like conviction and kind of confidence in like, you know, yes, I accomplished these things, but it could have been done in such a better way. It could have been a much healthier environment. And like, are there ways that we can, you know, pay it forward to the next generation in the way that others had done it for ours? So yeah, I know I wish I could say that it like it had been an easier road. It certainly was a hard one. But I am, you know, I came out the other side. Like you can like, you know, lean on those people that you know have your best interests, that like you can trust, that can kind of help you survive that, work through that. And then I encourage anyone to, if there's ways that you can speak up or make change, like do it, because the more people who are willing to kind of like call it out, the more likely that it might change in the long run too. So.
Yes, absolutely. And it's such a hard experience to go through at such a vulnerable point in your career where you have this contract and you
Right.
are financially locked into this, and your performance determines your paycheck and vice versa.
Right.
And,
Right.
you know, it's so hard because there's so much being held over you in those moments. And
Yeah.
being in that environment, you know, I can only imagine how oppressive that felt and how trapped you might have felt. And I'm curious, you know, if there's anyone listening who's like, I'm kind of struggling with the environment I'm in. Are there any red flags you could speak to, maybe early on, or things that you wish maybe looking back that you could have thought differently about or even brought more attention to?
Oh, it was hard. The behaviors of my coaches were known by the bosses and the people who signed my contracts, so that it felt like there weren't many places to go, besides like my family for support. Safe sport is a tool that like I wasn't aware of at the time, but is a resource for our athletes. Yeah, it was all those things that you described, and one that like I would not want to, like I loved my pro athlete career, but I wouldn't want to live it again because it was not at all easy. But if there are leaders or resources that you can turn to, you should. USA Track and Field and USO, like USOPC has an ombudsman. You could reach out to them. Like there are resources out there. But in my experience, I remember just feeling kind of like stuck, and I remember feeling like the situation, like the treatment was not right, but I didn't know what to do about it. And so you know, I'm grateful that there seem to be better tools and resources to hopefully prevent those such things from happening. Yeah, it was hard. It was a really hard aspect of my professional running career.
Yeah, that's just, again, feeling incredibly trapped and like there's not really anything you can do about it. And I think it's really important that if you are in those situations, you're not blaming yourself and you take the opportunity to talk to people about it, talk to people around you. Like you said, just the more people that are saying things, you never know who that might end up helping or what that might
Right.
change. And for you, you know, it did change things, but you had, despite all of that, had an incredible professional career, three-time Olympian, going to be a bronze medalist here very soon, which is
Yeah.
a whole other story.
Yes.
but throughout your pro career, you also gave birth and came back postpartum. And that was something you alluded to earlier as well, is another form of pressure from the contract to kind of get back to running. So can you speak a little bit to the training through pregnancy and postpartum experience that you had?
I remember getting, well, I waited till later in my career because I was afraid of the consequences. I'd seen other mothers struggle through maternity, like do incredible things, but it was hard. And for some of them, you know, that rush to get back led to injury. Unfortunately, that was the case for myself. I had tried really hard, especially in my first pregnancy, to take a really as balanced of an approach as I could. You know, what I will say, this was 2017. I was shocked by how little readily available, kind of credible information existed around how to be active during pregnancy and in postpartum. You know, everything from how much volume was okay to, you know, postpartum, how do you balance caloric needs? Or with training and breastfeeding, you know, everything. It was like it was nothing. I was able to give phone calls to a few of the, you know, athletes that were also friends that were also moms and sort of get their advice on what they did. And what was kind of further shocking was that like they were having the same. I thought like, okay, well, maybe it's me and I just don't have the resources nearby. But I realized that whether it was a friend in the UK or in the Bay Area or kind of a different part of the country, like nobody really had a great, like, here's a protocol to follow. I was lucky to meet Jessica Dorrington, who's a PT in Portland, Oregon, where I was training at the time. She's certified in both pelvic floor and orthopedics. And so she was able to be kind of my guide through pregnancy. And I had, you know, I took, like I said, this balanced approach of knowing I didn't want to train at this really intense level, but also knowing that movement gave me both physical and mental health. And like I say, I meditate through movement. Like I love being outside. And so understanding kind of how to gauge my effort, whether it be through heart rate or talk test or Borg scale, understanding the changes that were happening in my body so that I could support my body through those changes and through movement. I realized, like working with her, that a lot of the resources that are out there will tell you what exactly the size your baby is and what fruit it is, but very little about like how your body has changed. Her help was so instrumental in getting through that pregnancy and coming back postpartum. And even though I got injured because I had to, you know, race, start training full time 2 months postpartum, and race it like, you know, by 4 months, 5 months postpartum, we were still able to work together in a way that really helped my body actually come back. Like once I finally got through that injury and was able to recalibrate again, I remember leading up, like in 2020, leading up to that, the Olympics that was postponed, running 200s that were faster than I had run in my 20s because I had actually spent all this time working on my core, pelvic floor, that connection between my like upper and lower body. So all that to say, like it just felt like this blank space that needed to have better voices in it. In the years since, we've had a lot more awareness and a lot more information put out there. And Jess and I paired together to make Strong as a Mother, which is a book all about, you know, kind of taking you from the day you get pregnant to the 12 weeks postpartum, so the 4 trimesters of pregnancy, and really helping mom understand all the things that, you know, I shared, like I needed to learn through her help when I was pregnant.
It's incredible. And yes, they published a book, Jess and Shannon together published this book, Strong as a Mother. And it is such a great resource. And like you said, one of the first of its kind, which is shocking because it's 2026 and there's still, I mean, we have more information, you know, than you did, which is great, but we still need more. And having that resource is so important. And especially when we layer in, you know, going through pregnancy, postpartum, so many body changes, which in and of themselves is so hard to navigate. And you're kind of grappling with this balancing. You're grateful to have a healthy baby in pregnancy, but then you're also sort of grieving a changing body. And then you add the athlete component in where your body has been this vessel that you've achieved dreams with, and now it's changing. And just, you know, from a body changing standpoint, Can you give any advice to somebody who might be struggling with body changes and who might be tempted to eat less as a result or change their approach to nutrition in a more destructive way?
Yeah, I was not someone who loved being pregnant. I loved being a mother. I knew I wanted to be a mother since I was a little girl. But I, as an athlete, I loved that, and a dancer, I loved that body control and the ability of like the more effort I put in, the more time that passed, the more kind of like the finer control I had over this body of mine. And in the pregnancy process, it was very much about I needed to release control. And so that was hard for me to kind of adjust to that. I was lucky to, like I said, have Jess sort of helping me understand these changes, both through her help in the routines that she gave me. And then in our book, we have each trimester these exercise routines that you can do that are support any mom anywhere. Like it's really about like how do you support your body through the changes that you're doing, but like prescriptive kind of exercise routines that you can follow so you can have something to kind of lean into. I think for me, I didn't like the changes of my body. The nutrition aspect of it, like I didn't live that experience of trying to control, use food to control those changes that were happening. But I do recall postpartum, just having to have a better awareness of like fueling needs than I had maybe paid attention to in the past because, your body has like a recovery timeline that is beyond the day of delivery. It takes several weeks for your, uterus to come back to size, for your muscle, kind of strength, or like elasticity to shift back to what it was pre-pregnancy. And then because I was breastfeeding, I remember in retrospect, I felt like I was chronically undernourished, not intentionally, but I didn't understand what I needed to do for fueling to like adjust. And then also you're so busy. Like once you're out the door, if you don't have those snacks with you, you may not get them. If you don't eat before you get in the door, you may not get a chance for another hour or two. And so the need to kind of like plan better, which I got to eventually, but I think that did, that is one of the factors that can contribute to injury. And red S is something that's harder to track postpartum if you're not getting your period because you don't ne necessarily get it immediately after you've had a kid. So all that to say, it feels overwhelming in the moment. I think that there are some groups doing more research on these topics of fueling for athletes, female athlete bodies, and like some also around female athlete bodies with breastfeeding. But I mean, we have to call out the fact that most research studies around athletes are not about women. And so, and there's even a smaller subset that would be like active moms. And so it's really a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of like trial and error. Strong as a Mother was our attempt to be one of the like one tool that our moms could have to help empower them in that pregnancy process. But there's so much work to be done. And I know, Molly Huddle and Alicia, and Sarah Slattery, I think they're working on another book that, I think the more once, like we said at the very beginning, like the more voices that can come in and like add their expertise, the better for, better for the community that we're in.
Yes, absolutely. And it's so important for athletes like yourself to do the work that you're doing. You've done a lot of advocacy work in different areas, postpartum being a big one, but you also have your own nonprofit. Tell us a little bit about what that is, why you and your husband founded that.
Yeah. So Pablo, my husband, Pablo Solaris, is from Mexico, and had the Mexican national record in a few events. We started dating in 2010. We married in 2013, but in 2012, so a couple years into dating, we decided to start imagining more as a way to, well, the moment for me, I was at a training camp in Mexico in San Luis Potosí, and the track we were using had I think it was like a high school PE class on the infield. And I just remember seeing all the boys were like really engaged in the soccer game, and the women were, when the ball was on their side, like They would kind of get up and move it around, but when it wasn't on their side, they'd just be sitting and chatting. And I remember thinking like this kind of dissonance between here I was like training so intensely, trying to prepare for, the world champs or the Olympics. I guess it was 2012, so the Olympics, and how transformational sport had been in my life and in my husband's life. But if you don't have a role model or you don't see like it does, if it's not something that's part of your daily life, you might not ever engage with it. And so when we started imagining more, it was about kind of creating role models for young people that we wished we had had. And, it's evolved into we do a summer camp. The theme really is this idea of empowerment through sport. And for me, that means not just teaching running at like skills and drills and running on trails, but also having this component of information sharing. And so we talk about, demystifying the college recruiting process. We talk about finding the right shoe for your body. We talk about nutrition through the lens of fueling for sport. And I think it's so important. And I know we talked before we started recording, like even just the name of your podcast, this idea of really helping people think about food as fuel. Just I think if I go back to when I was a kid, that awareness that food was an essential component of success helps you make just, when you're in that decision, that turning point moment might help tip you in the direction that's more healthy. So yeah, we have our summer camps. We host them in Marin at San Domenico, which is a school, a beautiful campus. It's stunning in the Marin County area, north of San Francisco. It's a 1 week camp, kind of junior high school ages. It's very much a labor of love, but I know that my career was, I achieved what I did in my career because of those kind, smart, insightful people that helped keep me on a good path. And, trying to be that resource for others is really important.
I love that. It's such amazing work that you're doing, and the sport is so lucky to have such an incredible role model like yourself, and not to mention your kids. So, kind of wrapping up with some final thoughts, what do you hope that your kids learn about sports or being active and fueling their bodies in general? What do you hope they take away?
Oh, yeah. I really have this top of mind these days because my daughter is 7 and my son is 3. And they just started a, the only exposure we'd given them to running was just like, mommy is going out for a run, daddy's going out for a run. Like, kind of, they would maybe once my daughter was really little when I was still track racing. So she would be at the track, but she doesn't really remember it. But they just started a little after school running camp, Joy's Jackrabbits. Joy
Oh.
Upshaw is the warmest heart. I was wary to introduce them to running, especially too early, because I didn't want them. I've seen a lot of kids who are like, ugh, my parents, like all they ever talk about is running. It takes me away from my parents, like takes my parents away from me. But seeing her and the way that Joy introduces all the track events to these kids, so she's trying hurdles and long jump and javelin, which, I think also in our earlier conversation, like if you're gonna have your kids do track and field early, have them go to some kind of camp if you can find it where they can try all of the like several events that track and field has to offer. And, we really at home talk about the importance of food as fuel and that, like, if you want to grow a strong, healthy body, you need to be eating good foods. And we certainly, like, the kids certainly get their Slurpees and their popcorn at the movie theater, and they love their lollipops that they'll get after dance class or whatever it might be. Like, they certainly, it's not like we have tried to say, like, no sugar at our house by any means. But we really more so try to emphasize that, like, food, it helps you grow. It helps you, like be healthy. Like we call it your growing food. Have you eaten your growing food? And so I think, when I try as much as possible to really talk about it in those terms and then model as best I can, good habits for our kids as well.
I love that. I think all athletes could ask themselves if they're eating their growing foods today. So,
I know,
everyone ask
right?
yourself that
Yeah. Have you eaten your growing food?
Yes. That's
Yes,
amazing.
it's
I
cute.
love
They're
that.
like this morning though, they're like, I don't want to eat my growing food. I want the lollipop from Valentine's Day. They did, my son had his like preschool Valentine's Day exchange and of course came back with like all kinds of treats. And so those are always, you know, anyone who's got kids or nieces and nephews, you know what I'm talking about, those battles. But I always go back to as well, it's like, and my husband and I will have this conversation often. We'll say, you know, like it's not a bad thing for kids to eat whatever treats they want. The key is like building that strong foundation at home, that the consistent things that they're interacting with are healthy, balanced, growing foods. Because then that becomes kind of a part of their lifestyle and part like habitual as part of their lifestyle. And then the other stuff can be for the fun times. So yeah.
Yes, I love that. Your fun foods, your growing foods, they all have a place on your plate, which is so
Yeah.
important. So
Yes.
that's incredible. Well, thank you so much for sharing your inspiring story. I was going to wrap up really quick with our fun rapid fire questions if you're
Okay.
ready.
Let's do it.
Okay. What is your go-to pre-run snack?
Ooh, okay. I would say I had two main ones when I was competing. It was either oatmeal, and I do often like yogurt, fruit, and almond butter. I digest almond butter a lot better than peanut butter. So pre-run, I would do that. Or it would be kind of like yogurt with fruit and granola. The granola would usually, you know, the oats and like the nuts. They're essentially the same thing. It was just like sometimes I wanted a warm thing and sometimes I wanted a cool thing. But that combination for me, especially when I was going to like 3-hour training sessions, it would give me quick energy, but also some lasting energy as well. And then, you know, I would supplement through the workouts with those electrolyte drinks or like goos and things like that. But that was a really like tried and true meal for me when it came to morning workouts and to training.
Perfect. And I love that there's some variety. You don't have to eat the same thing every
Yeah,
time, people. You can have some variety.
it might kind of be the same thing,
Yeah,
like
but a
made of the same things,
variation.
but it feels very different.
Yes, I love that. That's great. What would you pick for your last meal?
Oh goodness. My last meal. So it would be like a nice steak with maybe like a yummy salad. I love salads with like I actually love salads, but I always make my salads like fun with good toppings, like green onions or tomatoes or nuts or cheeses or whatever. Key to salads as well, like a really high quality olive oil and a high quality balsamic vinegar, and then like that is your dressing. So I'd have that. So a steak and a yummy salad, and then some like French fries or something like that. And then I'd probably have a nice glass of red wine. So if I had only one
Perfect.
more meal left,
That
that's what it would be.
sounds like a nice one.
Yeah.
What is your favorite dessert?
My favorite dessert. I feel like these days I'm not like a big dessert person. I'm not a big sweet tooth. I'm more of a savory girl. So like I could be just as happy with like a meat and cheese and crackers plate with like olives, that kind of thing. But lately, if I want like a quick fix in the evening, it'll be maybe some dark chocolate, a scoop of peanut butter, a glass of milk. And like for me, that is like very satisfying and satiating and like puts a smile on my face.
That's actually one of my favorite evening snacks. That's so funny. Okay, all right. Do you have a least favorite food?
Oof. Yeah, what do I not eat often? I'm like nothing that like horrifies me comes to mind. When I was little, I hated soup, but now I love it, so that doesn't count anymore. I think I must have had like some like Campbell's chicken noodle soup and the smell would get to me.
Yep.
That would probably like I would say if there's something I wouldn't eat that I've tried, because there's some foods I haven't ever even tried, but like a canned Campbell's chicken soup, that smell just like still gets to me. Or what's the other one that I won't do? I had it, but I forgot it. So
That's
yeah,
okay.
we'll go with
The
that.
Campbell's soup, that's so funny. It definitely
Campbell's.
reminds me of being sick.
Yeah, exactly.
I
No,
get
thank
that.
you.
If you could travel anywhere in the world for a food experience, where would you go?
Ooh. Well, I'm lucky I go to Mexico often because of my husband's family, and they have avocados, ceviches, like queso, like you know, tortillas and cheese every way you could imagine. So like that you can never go wrong. I've never been, well, I've been to Japan, but only for training camps. I do love sushi. So I think if I, one of the trips that we were talking about is getting over to Japan, and I would love to have some delicious food from
Amazing. That sounds so good. And do you have
there.
a go-to lazy meal that you guys make at home?
Oh, yeah. I mean, our laziest go-to meal is in San Francisco. There's Little Original Joe's and like Joe's of West. Like, those are like kind of like institutions almost. We're lucky that the family that owns them is also at our daughter's school, and they're the most wonderful people. But they have a store in our neighborhood with like, the pre-made salads, frozen lasagnas, raviolis, and meat sauce and soups. And so that's our laziest meal. But it's great because it's like, good price, tastes great, really easy. If I'm making it, it's probably some salad like I was describing. My husband will make a steak, and then I'll create some sort of, the kids will have maybe like sliced bell peppers or sliced cucumbers or something like that. So that's like a go-to for us often as well.
Perfect. Easy and balanced. I love
Easy and balanced. Yeah, we try,
it.
we try.
Yeah. And then last one, what is your favorite coffee or tea drink?
Ooh, I have been actually having a lot more tea lately. I love coffee, but I feel like the acid in it will like get to my stomach if I have
Yeah.
too much, and I also can't have more than a couple cups or I get a headache. So if I get a coffee, I get an Americano short with room, like with cream. And if I have tea, I'll do like usually when I was in the couple times I went to China, they taught us about how you do like the first wash and then you have the like black tea. If it's a nice tea, the first wash as it is, and then I'll do another one that's like a longer steep with like with some whole milk or something like that.
Never heard of that. That's so interesting.
Yeah, I'm probably
Amazing.
butchering it for all of you tea aficionados, but I did learn, but I did do that, and I did learn that, and it
Cool.
tastes delicious.
Amazing. Well, maybe if you're a tea person, look into that.
Yeah.
But otherwise, thank you so much, Shannon. It's been so fun talking with you. I'll put some links to your resources in the show notes, and
Awesome.
best of luck with everything coming up, and congratulations on your medal.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Maddie. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Fueling Forward podcast. If you'd like to keep up with Shannon, you can find her on Instagram. You can also find her book at local bookstores and online. Next week's episode will be a Q&A with me, so if you'd like to submit a question to be answered on air, you can do so at my website, www.fuelingforward.com, under the podcast tab, or you can email me at fuelingforwardpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you at the next Fueling Forward Friday.